Good afternoon. First, I'd like to thank Dr. Shapiro, Dr. Gutierrez, Dr. Brown, and Ms. Moreno for their wonderful presentations, and thank you all for coming. My name is Lisa Cacati Stone. Currently, I'm a senior fellow and faculty with the Robert Johnson Center for Health Policy at the University of New Mexico. The focus there is to train the next cadre of Latino Native American researchers who are getting their doctorates in either economics, political science, or sociology to have an emphasis and training on reducing health disparities. So if any of you are looking for a pre-doctoral program, if you know anyone, I'd be happy to talk to you afterwards. We're recruiting. We also have a few visiting faculty and fellowship positions. So that's my public service announcement. And then does this turn, you have to go down this with the keyboard? The mouse will do it? Okay, thank you. Thank you so much.
It's not intuitively reasonable. It's the left instead of the right.
The research team for my project is, most of my work has been on applied translational research, but also in applied political work, working with counties, state government, the state legislature in New Mexico, as well as in Congress. I worked for Senator Kennedy on his health committee. And the interest here that I'm presenting today is just a broader part of a broader research agenda to look at the non-health policies that affect health of immigrants in the U.S. My collaborators are not here today, but I want to acknowledge them as part of the team from the University of New Mexico. Just shortly, I'll be talking about a quick background on the motivation for this study and some of the theoretical frameworks and concepts that has informed this research. My research questions, I'll talk briefly on the methods, but we'll spend more time on some of the preliminary findings and results. This is a pilot project. It's a beginning of a longer term, more comprehensive research, so I just want to emphasize that. Why do we want to look at immigrants? For the reasons of our colleagues and co-presenters and much of the work that many of you sitting here are doing, is that even though the data is inconclusive, we do know that in general, immigrants come with some sort of health advantage. And that health advantage that has an expiration date with that visa that they come with in terms of that visa of health. We know with Latinos, despite lower socioeconomic status, the data is more conclusive around infant mortality weight. There's also some other positive mental health behaviors, especially among women around substance use and lower prevalence of substance abuse. With our API, Asian Pacific and Islander immigrants, we also look at there's lower rates of psychiatric disorders. And there's also distinct and heterogeneous patterns, but some immigrant health advantage with our Afro-Caribbean populations as well. What I found in looking at the research out there is that there's little on the ways that local governments respond to immigrants. We know more about state responses and reactions and federal responses, but as you were discussing with your ICE raids and so forth, what's the interesting case here are local responses. And from some of Nancy Krieger's work in social determinants of health, scholarship out there, both nationally and internationally, we do know that context does matter in terms of health. When we think about the framework for understanding health as we consider immigrants, certainly the political, economic, and social conditions in which people live really do make a difference. And those factors that are happening inside and outside the healthcare system really do matter, particularly policies. Again, the gap here in the literature is definitely around how do we link social policies and their impact on health status at the local level. I want to distinguish that federal immigration policies do have an impact on localities, on our budgets, on the utilization and quality of services, on the political and economic character of communities. And for the last 5 years, the National Conference of State Legislatures and several of my colleagues with the Immigrant Project there have been Dirk's, Dirk Hagen, excuse me, has been doing an annual report on state responses to immigrants and a typology of that. Michael Fix has followed with the Migration Policy Institute, so they have a lot of different policies online. Immigration policy versus immigrant policy. Although the federal government has jurisdiction over immigration policy, who enters, who leaves, state and localities remain responsible for immigrant policy, those policies that help newcomers integrate into the fabric of daily life. I looked at the literature in sociology, economics, and political science, as well as in public health, and the most, I would say, the most expansive explanations for integration and incorporation from the sociology literature and folks from political science. But there hasn't been a connection as much between immigrant incorporation and integration and health outcomes. And I think this is really an area for further exploration of many of us who want to look at both those factors within and without and outside the healthcare system. Integration policy, as Michael Fix says, is the ultimate test of whether immigration succeeds in creating stronger communities. Yet, we have such ad hoc policies. And as a failure of national health immigration reform, again, localities are still grappling with what to do with their constituents. And they're the most intimate in terms of the upfront day-to-day issues that come up, like housing. These are on the on your right. Are the immigrant integration indicators. Again, it's inconclusive what the literature is saying around what are really good measures of incorporation and integration, but certainly education and housing. And most of the activities have been around human trafficking, law enforcement, and employment across the state levels. So my research very quickly looked at, as a preliminary pilot study, is to start getting at, can we examine the relationship between how counties and local governments are responding to demographic growth, and how do what are some of the potential explanations for their responses, and giving the findings as public health researchers and practitioners, what insights can we develop and have for promoting and protecting population health? The research methods I took with my colleagues, I had a demographer on the team, quantitatively, is we selected thirteen counties from eight states across the nation. And that selection was basing on the extracting and ranking of population data from the US Census. And we use measures of growth from the demographic scholars such as Audrey Singer and so forth from 1990, 2000, and 2006. After we ranked, then we wanted to look at diverse sampling. So I'll show you very quickly the sample counties that we pulled. Then I did an extensive literature review from different, again, from economics, sociology, from health services, and social sciences. And then I also looked at reports online, anything we could find in terms of secondary data through LexisNexis searches and websites. That's just a quick review of some of the policies that we looked at, both formally and informally, which are both important. The sample is a combination of traditional destinations from Audrey Singer's work, again, and some of the other demographers. And those areas are, as we know, and as some of our colleagues pointed out, have been around traditional metropolitan areas. But the new and emerging communities are more rural, and some of them are suburban, or a cluster of sort of or a combination of suburban metro areas. The eight states and 13 counties in Virginia on the East Coast were Prince William, Fairfax, and Loudoun. In Minnesota, the combination of Scott and Hennepin, Nevada, Clark County, Gwinnett, Newton, and Henry in Georgia, Maricopa County in Arizona, Cook County, Illinois, Harris County, Texas, and Bernalillo County in New Mexico. Since I'm from New Mexico and this was a project funded by the RWJ Center, I wanted to make a New Mexico county a comparative county. I'm going to skip this one, but in brief, the demographic profile ranged from below average growth at 6 to 7.5% to 28%. that would be the first row. And then as you look below, we looked also at the growth rate across 16 years. And the average annual growth rate, and divided by that by 16, obviously. And we see the greatest growth was around Newton, Georgia, Scott, and Henry County, Georgia. And the lowest growth were some of the traditional states, except for Fairfax, Cook County, and Harris County, Texas. Just a brief socio-demographic profile. The three Virginia counties had relatively high incomes with high educational levels, a concentration of jobs in management and other high-paying jobs. Fairfax County had the highest educational attainment of the foreign-born in any of the 13 counties we selected, and there was a significant presence of Asian Americans, immigrants, and nearly half of the foreign-born are from Asia in both Fairfax and Loudoun counties. In Minnesota and Nevada counties, as we look at the educational levels in Hennepin and Scott, they were also high, with 13% with master's degrees, compared to Loudoun County, Virginia, although far below the level in Fairfax County, Virginia. These counties were also more typical in the proportion of foreign-born with less than high school education, roughly 1/3. The region of births from these areas were also varied. Immigrants from Latin America vary from 27% to 61%, and Asians comprise a substantial proportion of 1/4 to nearly 1/2. The distinctive group here is African immigrants, with nearly 1 out of 4 foreign-born in Hennepin and Scott counties. As we look at the Georgia area and Georgia counties, the three counties there have, as you may recall, included 2 with tiny foreign-born populations in 1990 and grew rather quickly during the next 16 years. The most frequent jobs constitute a mix of construction to transportation, and also administrative jobs were common, with the exception of Henry County, which had a significant presence of foreign-born and health practice occupation. Median incomes for immigrant households are in the 50K per range. Let's look closely finally at the last cluster of counties, which were traditional counties, and they were very diverse. The percent of high school dropouts amongst the foreign-born is the highest in this group, with the exception of Cook County, Illinois, Chicago. Similarly, the proportion of foreign-born adults with master's or higher's is also lower at a range of 6% to 9%. Construction occupations are among the most frequent in these counties, with the exception of Cook County, where production and office and administrative jobs are more frequent. So that's the context and background. And what I want to just share with you quickly, as we look at those varied counties, that there was what we found as I analyzed the qualitative data, is that there was varied responses both by state and counties. You may have a state that's more restrictive, but a county be more progressive. You may have a state that's restrictive, a county restrictive, or a progressive state and more restrictive county. There were different combinations. And the question here, in terms of a research policy perspective, is can we start looking at patterns across the US and what might explain some of these responses? So looking at some of Fix's work and Rumbaugh and Portes' work, they varied from more restrictive, exclusionary, and policies that penalize folks to more expansive inclusion and protective policies. Virginia, the state legislature focused on employment, identification of licenses, forcing and deterring illegal immigration. This state had the most provisions and efforts to study immigrants. They wanted to know who they were, what did they cost, down to geocoding. This could be good, this could be bad. They had a 2005 proposal to ban undocumented from state and local health care, and then you see a variety of responses with the different counties, where Prince William was the most, I would say, penalizing. They had a landmark resolution allowing police to enforce immigration laws and deny public benefits to undocumented immigrants, and Loudoun County followed suit. And again, these are a review of documents as well as newspaper articles and other secondary information. We look at Minnesota and Nevada. Minnesota was one of the most progressive states and those counties of Scott and Hennepin, the most progressive, of course, Hennepin being the twin city. Although they were progressive at the local level, the governor at that time, during the time I looked at these policies, Pawlenty had a package of executive orders that was put out to exclude and restrict public benefits, toughen penalties, and tighten up the ICE and local law enforcement efforts. Now, Nevada has had a high growth rate of immigrants, so I wanted to see how they're responding. The verdict's still out because it was difficult to find evidence from the 60,000 foot range versus the 60 foot on the ground. But their state legislative proposals mainly were restricting educational benefits. They looked at crime and trafficking due to the area of Las Vegas, as well as focusing on trade and tourism and homeland security. What's happening in Georgia? Georgia established itself as a more hardcore state, taking a hard line against immigrants and restrict access to services. There was activity, that most of the activity happening in Gwinnett was around law enforcement and ICE. Henry and Newton, the evidence that's secondary, again, at the 60,000 feet level was still inconclusive of what's happening there. Finally, Arizona and Illinois. Arizona is considered the laboratory for new ways to crack down on immigrants, both at the state level and in Maricopa County. And I see some folks must be from Arizona. you know the players. And anyway, we have Governor Napolitano at the time, who's now head of Obama's administration for ICE, was actually implemented the first initiative powering local law enforcement with ICE agents. So she's considered the innovator. Cook County, again, being more progressive and inclusive, had a sanctuary for immigrants, both in Chicago and in the county. And Governor Baglovich, for all his dramas and scandals, was actually very pro-immigrant in terms of access to care, especially for all children. I want to just end with Texas, with a mix of responses from Operation Wrangler to more inclusive policies. Many of you are very familiar with the Harris County interpretation that Senator Cornyn was involved in. But basically, when we look at the Welfare Reform Act and its devolution to states and counties in 1998, there's still interpretation around whether that applies to how the interpretation of how counties want to use their public funds to serve immigrants. New Mexico has both been inclusive and exclusive, inclusive at the executive level with Governor Richardson, to more exclusive at our UNM Public Serving Hospital. And I could tell any of you more about that later on. I'd like to just end with the other qualitative information that I analyzed is what are potential explanations serving as the next step for a quantitative study? Ideology and electoral partisanship. Political ideologies are very important here. And the more progressive states and areas being predominantly Democratic, and as expected, conservative hardliners often pinned against moderate politicians in areas like Maricopa. Other potential explanations are really about the infrastructure and capacity of the safety net, as we also saw in New Orleans, the existing, and perhaps as due to critical events or economic downturns, we're going to see with local less capacities of our safety net public healthcare systems. There's a well, there would be. Okay, there would be two good things if you're from there, right? Okay. I'll end with another potential explanation is group political power, civic engagement, and leadership. And I think Dr. Chipiro was touching on this. And again, the effort here is to look at patterns, to try to come up with a topology that can be tested through a quantitative study. Areas where the ACLU were the strongest were Nevada, Virginia, Arizona, New Mexico. Coalitions push political agendas and lobby state legislators in Congress, and it goes both ways, from the more conservative political agendas from the Minutemen in Arizona to the more progressive efforts in Illinois. So again, political activity is an important explanation in terms of immigrant integration. I'll end What does this mean in terms of health equity? I want to just focus on what's really possible in this current economic climate and political climate. Number five, possibly, keep doing the outreach at the local level and face-to-face with immigrants to be navigators with them into as entry into the, our safety net system. I think six and seven are really important, working at the local level to diffuse the anti-immigrant sentiment and to change the conversation, to really move the conversation from these, as Dr. Shapiro was talking about, from a really demeaning and very hateful narrative to something that considers all people as human beings and that's more inclusive, and to establish a set of policies, whether it be an association like APHA, or your local institution, to really set the groundwork for establishing more inclusive policies that promote integration. And I'll end here. Thank you for your patience. Your name, please?
Sylvia.
Sylvia, your question was how the research plans for next steps and linking it to health outcomes of immigrants. I think that's the challenge here is finding, I found enough secondary data sets to actually like political affiliations and so forth, how people vote, some county data sets. But as most of you know, our data sets that are national, the National Center of Health Statistics, U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, very few do analyses by, collect by race, ethnicity, particularly citizenship status, the BRFSS and so forth. So I think that this is the, I think the niche for future research is to do some local studies to find funding to really look at and linking the impact of these policies on health status.
My name is Alejandro my questions are for Dr. Jaime. Where in California did the study take place? I saw in the numbers there wasn't farm workers represented.
Farm workers were represented. It was in Southern California primarily.
How did you come up with the numbers to call?
The numbers that were used? I did a secondary data, so we didn't actually do the... You know what I can do is I can point you where you can actually get all the information about the data set. ISCPR, that's where I got the data set. Anyway, touch base with me afterwards. I'll give you my card and I can get you the specific data that you're looking for. But, and it was, notice also, it was a survey that was done in 2001. So it was a few years ago, but the information that we found is obviously relevant to what's going on with Latino immigrants today. Okay, and did you have other questions?
No, I just wanted to see the
breakdown. Let's talk afterwards, okay? Thank you.
But you have some really interesting pieces of information.
But there was very little connecting between what was said and the implications for universal proposals. If we do have universal health care forthcoming, what is it likely to change? And if we do have it, what is it not likely to change? And so I, you all look very young to me, so I would encourage you all.
What is your name?
My name is Emilia.
Emilia.
And so I would encourage you all to making that leap. The issue of the county data, because you have some good funding there, that can be very important, and then you can use both narrative
Emilia, I'm not as young as I used to be. And so the strategy I use after many years of evening meetings and working with community-based organizations is to incorporate this kind of thinking about health disparities and health equity, especially for our most vulnerable groups, into everything I teach, so that my students can become researchers who believe that you don't just collect data about inequality, you do something about it. That part of what it means to be an engaged citizen is that you do not stand by while people suffer, and that research can be a tool for opportunity. And that is one of the things that I think is very challenging in this area of work, because I have to tell you, I am afraid. I am afraid every time I do this research. We don't keep our lists of our immigrants that we interview anywhere. I discovered after doing a survey on my campus, I asked the stupid question, do you have legal concerns about immigration status? An anonymous survey, but I discovered that 14% of students on our campus have some sort of documentation issue. Probably mostly international visas, but some undocumented students. We immediately eliminated that question from any of our data reporting and from our survey, and it wasn't 6 months before ICE had a conference at MIT on how best to identify undocumented students on college campuses. So I'm aware that police actions are meant to isolate. I mean, I think one of the things that Portes said about this work is that we have decided that we want immigrant labor, but we don't want the consequence, the human consequences of immigrants among us. And we've got to challenge that. If we want cheap immigrant labor, if we want people to take our dirty work and keep this economy afloat, just the Social Security that goes unclaimed keeps this economy afloat. You know, it's time for us to talk about the human impact of slave labor in this country and of state-sponsored violence.
That is not what I meant. And you are very, very, very
I think I know what you're. I think I know what you're addressing. The fact that all of our presentations. How did we bring them all together? You know, one thing. This is the first time for me to present at APHA, but one thing that I would like to have done is known all my co-presenters, and we could have collaborated before. So maybe this is feedback you give to APHA, but I agree with what you're saying, is that all of us are presenting on different but related topics. How do we tie it together for you guys at the end to have some policy recommendations? That's why I included policy recommendations in mine, because that was the emphasis of my paper, was policy recommendations. So we didn't do that. So you're getting what you got today. But, you know, your point is very well taken about having us collaborate to say maybe one or two things, what would we recommend for policy? I would say, you know, with my colleagues who are on the panel, please, any of you, feel free to jump in. But I think you saw an essence of all of ours that healthcare reform definitely needs to include immigrants. Healthcare reform definitely needs to be something that is comprehensive, that it does allow for safety net providers to provide care to us as Latinos in a culturally relevant and linguistically accurate fashion, that laws that preclude us because of our status we don't agree on those, right? That we do not want those in. So I think you kind of heard that consistently from all of the presenters in some form or fashion. My colleagues, please, you did most of the policy in terms of comparing states.
Well, it's a good question, and I want to know what other folks here think as well. And when you look at the House and the Senate provisions and the side-by-sides, I think the current package, where the question is, where will we get leverage? What's the window of opportunity? How do we talk in code? Because we're not going to win the argument. It's not even on the table whether we're going to cover immigrants. So the window of opportunity as public health practitioners and researchers is through the population health. Promoting population health, promoting health and wellness, that's across all of the proposals on the table right now. When you look at the side by side, that's the language being used, so that's the language we should be using. The other one is having a primary care, a medical home. Having a medical home, community health centers serve over 80% in some communities, 90% of our immigrant population. So community health centers rock. They're the place to put the additional funding. When you look at the quality provisions, those features of quality provisions, looking at outreach efforts that strengthen patient-provider communication patterns, whether it's linguistic. There's some provisions on the table around promotoras and community health workers. And we know that there's cost-benefit studies that really do promote that. When we look at coverage, the whole issue of Medicaid expansions to adults and population that have incomes of over 200%. If we hit the adults, then we hit the kids that are citizen children. So I think these are the other avenues. And finally, I think that's not being discussed on the table that we have to keep pushing and hitting home is that we do policy in silos. On the Hill, when we talk about labor policies and immigrants, the lawyers are doing those policies. When we're talking about occupational health and environmental justice, they're environmental people. We have very few public health policy people at the table in those other silos. And I think we need to really start streamlining and doing integration and educating our elected officials, but mainly their staffers. There's staffers who have expertise in everything except public health. So those are some thoughts.
And I think another possibility are international comparisons. He mentioned that many immigrants come from countries as poor as can be, and with healthcare systems that are actually almost non-functional, but still have access to it. So they may be bad, and the hospitals may be horrible. And that might be another avenue. And also, immigrants, she spoke of Fortes. Fortes did a paper in Spain about talking the favorites. The Latin American immigrants are the favorites in Spain. Here they are the least favorite. Well, but still, the fact that you have access to social
security. Because it's true that in Spain they have access to social security and national government
and access to national IT.
This is fabulous, this is what I want back. Emilia, you continue. Where are you from?
Where I'm from, Arizona.
Arizona. Because I'm hard.
Don't say I'm native.
And I feel like you were from Argentina as well.
So, yes, I am, and I said you're from Argentina. I could tell that. Where does somebody with a name like Anaí Vildrak or something like that?
Okay, yeah. Okay, okay. I'm Sally Finley, and I'm from New York City. I work a lot with community health workers, and I was very glad that you added promotoras because one of the things we discovered is that very many of the families that we work with our promotoras are in fact immigrants who would never say half the things they say to the promotora about things that concern the questions they have. And so in terms of bridging between the immigrant community
DULAC, National Council of Raza, Mavdev, all of these organizations. It's very important to be active with those. I know I work with them very closely, and there's a lot of, they're coming together. There's an organization that's kind of an umbrella of all of them called ASED, Hispanic Association on Corporate Responsibility. If you look at what that organization does, it's impacting in terms of the Fortune 500 companies, what they're doing with Latinos and immigrants. So this coalition building is key, if you will, and working through these organizations to promote immigrant policy that's favorable to us as immigrants, it's key to working with those organizations because they're doing a lot of work already in that arena.
I just wanted to follow up on that comment. Part of what I try to teach is that everybody has a contribution to make, no matter where you stand. If you become aware of these issues, you can then start thinking in creative ways about your academic contributions and how you think about your research and your potential partnerships, but also, I do a lot of provider training, so that's one of the reasons why I think about providers and what it means for providers to become more sensitive to the ways people you think are legal immigrants might be undocumented immigrants. Every time I talk about this in one of my classes, I discover that students that I thought were untouched by this have a partner who's an undocumented immigrant and are making a lot of decisions based on the possibility of being detained or deported. So this idea that I think people have become aware that, for example, it's a big move to make services trauma sensitive in a lot of fields. Mental health, substance abuse are becoming aware that violence exposure is something that complicates our attempts to provide treatment in many settings, and that that's becoming a design and training issue. And I'm just aware that many of us navigate our spaces with incomplete awareness of the consequences of what these patchwork of often contradictory policies, you know, the fact that we have the Chelsea police caught between the sanctuary commitment that they've made and their partnerships in the community, and the fact that when ICE shows up with a list of criminals, the police department has to treat them as criminals. And yet, they've discovered anytime they make a list of immigrants that they don't have the names correct. They don't even know how to think about our names correctly. So they have so many mismatches. One of the reasons why people get lost in detention is that they can't even keep accurate lists. They can't find people by name. So this idea that there's contradictory policies and that everybody has got to be thinking about what this means and how we can stand, because it's the nature of a police state to isolate people from one another. And forgive me for calling this a police state, but if you start to talk to immigrants who have been living the consequences of having their children racially profiled, some of these atrocities that are happening in the name of our government, and you have to decide at what point you step up. So that's a personal decision that everybody has to make, but I think if we make it collectively, it's less hazardous and more effective.
Okay, guys, this was me. I'm not going to invite you to have a concluding remark.